Okay, so I have the honor of being pushed out by my fellow organizers to give the first lecture in this sequence. This is the honor, but it's also worrisome because I don't quite know who the audience are. So I would like to ask you to please help me adjust the level of this lecture as we go along by asking questions. Now, while I am very sincere in asking for questions, I shall also occasionally take Fifth Amendment or suppress discussion as necessary. As I was preparing to this lecture, I've actually ended up envisaging a course of about 5 or 6 leisurely lectures on physics of information. Now, if I had 5 or 6 hours to do that, the plan of how it proceed would be more or less like this. I would start by telling you about conditional dynamics and entanglement, draw the parallels between logical gates used in quantum computation and the old process of measurement. Then I would go on and tell you about where the power of quantum computation arises from, quantum parallelism, the fact that a quantum computer is a gigantic interferometer experiment in some sense. Then I would go on to tell you and describe proposed, or at least some of the proposed implementations. And then, as we went through these proposed implementations, we would all realize that it's not that easy, and that the biggest enemy of quantum computation is decoherence. The fact that the environment is out there, in a sense, watching what every system coupled to it is doing. Now, this seemed a showstopper 5 or so years ago, but about that time, Peter Shor and Andy Steen came up with ingenious generalizations of classical ways of dealing with errors, so-called quantum error correction. So then I would go on to a lecture or two about quantum error correction, which is now a very nicely developed theory, tell you about strategies, focus on the fact that there are very nice proofs of how to deal with errors of all sorts. And then, at the end, I would go on to connect what I told you about with more general issues of dynamics, quantum dynamics, chaos, and the second law, etc. And I would not be able to resist to speculate about the future. Now, I've already wasted about 5 minutes, so I have 50 minutes instead of 5 hours. I'm still going to cram this stuff into the next 50 minutes. I might not completely succeed, but please interrupt anyway. It's more important that the lecture be heard than it be told. I am going to adjust the title slightly. As you will notice throughout, my emphasis is going to be on decoherence as it relates to quantum information, to the physics of information. The reason for the adjustment is that in some sense I've started looking at the issues of this sort, border between quantum and classical, physics of information in the quantum context, not because of quantum computation, but long before that, because I was worried about the transition from quantum to classical, about trying to explain how classical physics arises from within the context of quantum theory. Now it turns out that both in posing the problem of, let's say, interpretation of quantum theory, and in performing quantum computation, a central role is played by the quantum superposition principle. Now, why is it worrisome? A good way of stating this worry goes back to Einstein, who, in a letter written a year or so before he died, to Born, with whom he had an on and off discussion about the foundations of quantum theory, writes, "Let psi 1 and psi 2 be two solutions of the same Schrödinger equation. Then there are some also represent a solution of the Schrödinger equation with equal claim to describing a possible real state. when a system is a macrosystem, and when psi 1 and psi 2 are localized with respect to the macroscopic coordinates, so a system is a bottle of Coke and psi 1 and psi 2 are bottles of Coke here and there, then in by far the greater number of cases, this is no longer true for the sum. So localization with respect to the macro coordinates is a requirement which is not only independent of the principles of quantum mechanics, but moreover, incompatible with them. Somehow, there is a conflict between something we believe always happens at the macroscopic level, localization, and the basic tenet of quantum theory, superposition. Now, another authority writes about the same problem in a slightly different language. Space is big, really big. You just won't believe how hugely, mind-bogglingly big it is. I need a slight adjustment to this quote. This is the essence of both the promise and the problem presented by the superposition principle. We know that most of the objects, macroscopic, are stuck in a small corner of Hilbert space. Somehow you can't access all of the superpositions which lie in the promised land of the Hilbert space somewhere out there. Now, you can wear two hats and stare at this contrast. On one hand, you can worry how come in our daily lives all of the humongous Hilbert space gets eliminated and you are really stuck here in this classical niche. On the other hand, and this is a hat I'll be wearing most of the time today, you can say, wow, there's lots of room out there. Now, can we make money out of it? This is the attitude you take when you use this rest of Hilbert space for quantum computation. In effect, and this is the first iteration, a very brief iteration of a strategy quantum computers employ, is you use that humongous Hilbert space to store in n, say, spins, n quantum bits, 2 to the n different superpositions. And then you operate on these 2 to the n different superpositions. So you gain exponentially in volume by using this entire Hilbert space. Now, how do you move out there? How do you take off from this classical island? For that, you need dynamics and a specific example of the sort of dynamics used in both classical and the quantum version, quantum computers, is known as controlled knot. Controlled knot operates between two bits. These two bits could be or could have been classical. Control lives in this upper wire. Target bit lives in this lower wire. The role of the control bit is to conditionally flip the state of the target. So if the control is in a state 0, then no matter whether the target is in the state 0 or 1, it stays. Nothing happens. When the control is in the state 1, the state of the target gets flipped. Target in a state 0 becomes target in a state 1. Target in a state 1 becomes target in a state 0. This gate is obviously reversible, which is important. You cannot implement using unitary operations anything else but reversible gates. This was, of course, everything classical. Quantum mechanically, not much changes. except that now you are not restricted to having either of these bits in a well-defined state, 0 or 1. You can start in a superposition. So for instance, if you start your control bit in a superposition of 0 and 1, then if the target was initially in 0, you will end up by repeating this truth table in the 0-1 basis with this state. This leads to states which are entangled. So this takes you from the classical island where the correlations would be classical and boring to all sorts of very interesting correlations. Now, this is such a simple operation that you might think, well, you know, there's nothing to it, let's just do it and let's have a quantum computer. By the way, this gate plus arbitrary rotations of individual bits, which is sort of a trivial operation, form a universal set. You can perform any computation using alterations of these two. In effect, any two non-commuting operations on a Hilbert space form a universal set. So what is the problem? You can get an inkling of the problem by changing notation. You see, this very same operation happens in measurements. Now, your control is a system, presumably a quantum system. Your target is the apparatus, presumably a quantum apparatus. This is the measurement problem. You end up putting the apparatus in a funny superposition of two states. Clearly, apparatuses don't seem to like staying in such superpositions. There are other systems, and we can change notation again, which like even less staying in such superpositions. Since we do not observe Schrodinger cats in superposition of dead and alive, we can expect that we are going to have problems implementing in quantum logic these sorts of operations. Basically, because these sorts of complicated, entangled superpositions of states in the Hilbert space are not going to want to stay around. Now I shall discuss in more detail why they don't, but before we move out there, are there any questions at this point? So let me now continue with controlled knots and tell you that there is one more funny thing that happens with controlled knots. See, on the previous transparency, I had an arrow drawn from the top bit to the bottom bit, which indicated the direction of the flow of information. Now let me perform what is known as Hadamard transform. This is a very useful operation in quantum computation. Basically, change the basis in the Hilbert space. You can go back to the old basis, of course. Now, let's start looking at the operation of the old controlled knot in this new basis. I will take you sort of sketchily through some of the algebra. You see, if you have a state plus plus, and the first cat, by the way, always refers to the top wire, to the former control, and the second cat always refers to the former target, the bottom wire, then you can just repeat the truth table from the previous transparency. There are no sign changes, and you will conclude that nothing happens. Plus plus evolves into plus plus. Everything's fine. No problems. However, let's do this one more carefully. Suppose we start with plus minus, plus in the top wire, minus in the bottom wire. Now, I'm going to skip 1 over square roots of 2 as I did it already here. 0 plus 1, 0 minus 1, 0 and 0, nothing happens. 0 and minus 1, nothing happens. 1 and 0, you flip 0 to 1. 1 and minus 1, you flip 1 to 0. You gather terms, you conclude you have 0, 0 minus 1, plus 1, 1 minus 0. You change this sign and you end up with minus minus. Now this means that the very same gate, which had an arrow of implication pointing down in the 0, 1 basis, somehow in this strange Hadamard basis, has an arrow of implication pointing the other direction. Minus in the bottom wire gets communicated to the top wire. You can do as the exercise the two other cases and confirm it. Basically, in the Hadamard basis, this very same gate I had before looks like it's trying to operate in the opposite direction. This is an interesting fact, and it will be important later on. But let me summarize it for the time being, because it's sort of going to show up in a couple of places. You see, when you are doing a Hadamard transform, you are asking about the eigenstates of phase. So as your information is your original logical basis, that's how zeros and ones are usually called in these sorts of discussions, is flowing down in the controlled node gate, the phase information travels backwards. Now this is going to make an appearance in a couple of different places. One of them, very annoyingly, is when you try to do error correction, it turns out things you thought you never had to correct end up getting hammered from below with a phase sort of overflowing you. Second, you will end up discovering that in a sense this is what happens in the process of decoherence. As the environment acquires information about the system in some basis, in the complementary basis it feeds into the system phase noise, causing decoherence. We may or may not get there. At this rate, we won't. So let me proceed. So, one reason, apart from trying to tell you that CNOT is a two-way street that I wrote, Hadamard transform, is that essentially every computation starts by initializing your bits in a quantum computer in this sort of state. And the reason you do it is because then a state which is a product of such states and consecutive bits has all possibilities in it, all combinations of zeros and one. So now if you are able to run through quantum computation coherently, you are coherently using the same hardware at the same time exploring many different classical computations in parallel. Now, if you have problems where putting together coherently these many different answers gives you a great advantage, then you will gain by using quantum computers. So here is a slightly more formal description of where the power of quantum computation arises from. So, classically, in order to gain by parallelism, you would want to have as many processors as you want to run serial programs in parallel, say, different implementations of the same initial data. In a quantum computer, you are trying to make a gigantic interference experiment. you are trying to run many different processes in parallel, in superposition. So now the number of processes is set in effect by the dimension of the Hilbert space of your quantum computer. But the dimension of the Hilbert space is exponential in the number of physical qubits you are using to build that computer. So this is where you gain exponentially. Any questions at this point? It's all too clear, or it's been all heard before, or both. Now, the suspicion, in fact, in some sense, almost a proof that quantum computers can, for certain problems, do much, much better than classical computers, goes back, as far as I'm concerned, to Feynman. I sat in his course that he taught with John Hopfield and Carver Mead at Caltech some 20 years ago on physics of computation. And one of the main themes in that course was the fact that it's so hard to simulate quantum systems because of this explosion of superpositions, because of the explosion of the dimensionality of the Hilbert space with classical computers. So it was very clear that one of the obvious applications of quantum computers, if such existed, would be to try to simulate quantum processes. But, you know, this was sort of known but never quite nailed, and the field exploded only when it turned out that there is a very different sort of very computer-like or computer science-like problem which is also dramatically changed by quantum computation. Now, this is a problem of factoring of large numbers. You've all heard the story. These sorts of large numbers are used to transfer information without revealing it to enemies, etc. RSA algorithm. In 1994, Peter Shor has realized that factoring, which is exponential in the cube root of the length of the number, when performed with best ways of doing it in classical computers, can be made polynomial in the length of that number, if you had a quantum computer. Now, the algorithm is complicated, too complicated for a brief description. I won't go through it. I'll just draw your attention to the fact that you are supposed to do precisely what I told you you would have to do. You have, in parallel, to perform certain operations. So you are doing, in parallel, very, very many computations. And then you are adding them coherently. This coherent addition of many computations is what gives you the answer. What you end up is calculating a spectrum of a certain probability distribution and looking at the periodicity. Information about periodicity gives you the information about the factors. So, this is a sort of theoretical killer application which fired up imagination, brought a lot of attention to the field. People have started devising schemes to implement quantum computers using hardware. The first of them, which was, I hate to use the word successful because there are very small only quantum computers using any scheme today. Right, so there is no running quantum computer. But the first of these schemes was devised by Ignacio Cirac and Peter Zoller. What you need is a collection of bits which can communicate with each other and implement, for instance, controlled knot and rotations on individual bits. In their scheme, you are dealing with a chain of ions. this chain of ions is held in a trap in a harmonic potential. The information is stored in the ions, but there is one more very important degree of freedom which is used for communication. It's used like a bus bit. This is the phonon mode. The vibration of this whole chain. Now, if you are in the right corner of the parameter space, then you can make this chain vibrate in such a way that you, in effect, have a Mitzvah effect. In other words, when you have emission of a quantum, the recoil is absorbed not by individual ions, but by the whole chain. This means that you can do conditional quantum operations using presence or absence of the phonon in the vibrational mode. So, if you want to do a conditional rotation, you shine a laser at one of the ions, which has a frequency such that when it would be made up by the extra energy in the oscillatory mode, you would be able to cause a transition, turn one of these atoms from a ground to an excited state, or vice versa. This way, you can let these ions communicate. Two laboratories in the world are leading this effort, which has been pursued by, I'd say, five or so laboratories. These two are in NIST, in Boulder, and in Innsbruck. And they have chains of ions. They've managed to cool them. They've managed to control transferring information in chains of, well, about this length. Of course, that's not enough to do large-scale quantum computation. It's not good enough to factor even smallest numbers which can be factored. The scheme, which is different in conception, and in some sense much less ambitious and in some sense much more successful, has been, in fact, invented here 5 years ago. Neil Gershenfeld and Ike Chuang, during the previous quantum computation workshop, came up with an idea of implementing quantum operations in MR. This was done essentially in parallel, a slightly different scheme, by David Corey, Tim Havel, and Fahmy at Caltech at Harvard. What you do is you use a molecule, nuclear spins within that molecule as quantum bits. NMR allows you to address these spins individually, and as long as you can control the way in which they evolve, you can implement essentially controlled knot and phase rotations. Now, the problem with this scheme, there are several problems with the scheme. One obvious one is that molecules tend to be fairly small, especially if you want to have spins which talk to each other. They need to be neighbors. So transferring information between different pieces of NMR, of molecule using this scheme, is quite difficult. There are other, in some sense, more fundamental problems. When you do it in a liquid, and this is how most of the experiments to date have been done, you are dealing with a system which is essentially almost completely in equilibrium, with just a little bit of an imbalance sticking in one direction. The fact that you have just a little bit of imbalance means that the number of operations you can carry out using this scheme is limited. Nevertheless, proofs of principle of some of the algorithms have been made. Now, most ambitious kinds of schemes think ahead about condensed matter implementations. This proposal was put forward by Kane 4 years ago. It uses information stored in atoms of phosphorus implanted in a regular lattice of silicon. It tries to control the interactions between these spins and nuclei of phosphorus by letting the clouds which surround these nuclei talk or not talk to each other, and this is done by putting potentials on gates. This has not been built. There are many related schemes which have been proposed in the wake of Kane's proposal. I think it's universally acknowledged that we don't really know which of these schemes are going to be best and what's going to happen when you try to implement it. There are many other schemes which involve, say, superconducting gates, Josephson junctions, quantum optics, many of them very imaginative, some of them closer to implementations than others, but all of them rather far from implementation. Now, one overall problem of all these schemes can be noticed when you go to conferences on the subject. So when you get there, you get theorists talking about all sorts of imaginative things having to do with algorithms, operational errors, designs, etc. And experimentalists tend to be very monothematic. So what are they worried about? In some sense, these worries were presaged by people like Rolf Landauer, who realized that at least at the bottom, control of the wave function of a quantum system is an analog process. So ultimately, you don't know if you've made an error or not. At least that seemed to be the case 7 or 8 years ago. But let me turn specifically. So, you know, one of the obvious problems, even if decoherence of the sort that I'm going to focus on for next few transparencies wasn't there, would be just the fact that you cannot implement the gates perfectly. If you can't implement the gates perfectly, the wave function is going to wander away from where you want it to be. And then you will not know how to read off the state of your quantum computer, even though it's still pure, in order to get the right answer. So, in order to tell you very briefly about decoherence, let me describe it in terms of the caricature involving controlled NOT gates. So, as before, we can imagine we have control and target, but now there is one more participant. We cannot isolate ourselves completely from the environment. Now, we can even believe we've isolated ourselves completely because we think none of the quantities which are conserved, like energy, leak out of our system, but that's not enough. Because it's enough if the system influences the environment. Quantum information is extremely private. If the environment gets imprinted with some inkling of the state that we are trying to compute, it's all over. And appealing to this picture of controlled not being a CNOT, a two-way street, you can imagine what happens. Whenever the information from the sort of green part, which is a piece of a quantum computer, gets imprinted on the environment, there are phases going the opposite direction. So your interference experiment, your quantum computation, gets polluted by the phases fed from the environment. You can understand how sensitive this is doing very simple simulations not really even of decoherence, but just of this phase noise in individual gates. So suppose you cannot implement gates with 100% accuracy. Suppose you make fraction of percent errors. Now, we've looked at it, actually last time when we were here in Santa Barbara with Juan Pablo Paz and Cesar Miguel, what we did is we wrote on a classical computer a simulation of a quantum computer which factors a number. Now, if you can factor a number using a classical computer by simulating on a quantum computer, why don't you just do it? I'd be over with. Well, the biggest number we could deal with was 15. 21 was, I think, already too large. You are realizing very dramatically the power of the quantum computers by calculating the size of the biggest quantum computer you could simulate on a biggest existing classical computer. You end up with something like 40 bits. This might be good enough to factor numbers of the order of, 20-some, 30, not more. Anyway, we've done the factoring of 15. I think it involved 18 bits, some couple thousand operations. I don't want to bore you with details. Shor's algorithms is really two different pieces to it. One of them is modular exponentiation, and there was a module which did that. And the other one of them is Fourier transform, and Cesar Miguel, who was our most versatile computationally collaborator, implemented these. And at the end, as I told you, what you get when you did everything right out of Shor's algorithm, you get a function. Well, you Fourier transform a certain wave function, which comes out from the modular exponentiation, and you should get something which is very concentrated on very special points. The period of this tells you the factors of the number you're trying to factor. This is what happens when the error per gate, these rotations of atoms, we did it in a specific implementation with Schirach-Zoller computer in mind, okay, was 0.1%. Not too bad. 0.5%. That still looks good. I mean, you see that the probabilities no longer hit quarter. They stop just above 0.2, right, for each of these four peaks. Now, as the error increases to 1%, these peaks are about half of what they used to be. And so by now, when you measure, you have a half chance of ending up with incorrect answer. And when the error per gate is 5%, nada. There's another way of looking at this. You look at registers which are supposed to supply you with the answer, and if everything is perfect, and this is sort of a funny projection of part of the memory, right? I mean, the whole computer is 2 to power 18 by 2 to power 18 density matrix, so I can't plot it. But this is for no errors. And this is for 5% error. Very clearly, the sharp information which is localized in the right places gets clobbered. Now, let me just show it to you. Intermediate errors, intermediate pictures. The most worrisome is essentially a probability of getting a right answer as a function of error per gate. This scale is logarithmic, in case you can't see it. So for factoring 15, numbers bigger than 1%, errors bigger than 1% per gate are deadly. the length of the computation increases depending somewhat on the algorithm, with some power, say third power typically, of the number you're trying to factor. You could use this formula to basically convince yourself that unless your errors, if you are not doing an error correction so far, are, well, close to zero, you have no chance of factoring anything bigger than 15, maybe 35. We have a problem. Let's dwell on the problem a bit more. Let me come back to tell you in a bit more detail, not just about the errors which have to do with operations, with the fact that I can't make gates which are perfect, but errors which have to do with decoherence, with the fact that there's an environment out there watching the computation we are trying to perform. Now, one can restate the content of the previous transparency in a slightly more formal way. And let me do it. And I apologize for the density of this transparency. It's most of the time incomprehensible. But things I say while looking at it sometimes are comprehensible. And you are welcome to ask questions. So what is decoherence? Consider a system and some stuff around it, which I will jointly call an environment. Let me assume that system is initially in some pure state. And let me assume that there's an interaction between one and the other, which causes a correlation. Now, if you then decide that the system you're interested in, which may be your quantum computer, is the thing that you want to know about, you know what to do. You need to trace over the degrees of freedom of the environment. So you do the trace. When you are done with the trace, you're going to end up with a mixed density matrix. No surprise. Everybody since von Neumann knew that something like this is going to happen. The surprise which came up more recently is that when you do that, then if you fix the interaction, then essentially independently of the initial states of the system and the environment, you're going to end up with the same set of states on the diagonal of that traced reduced density matrix. So this fact that you end up with the same set of states means that there is a preferred set of states in the Hilbert space. I have argued elsewhere, and probably will say a bit more about it today, that these states are, in a sense, great candidates for the classical states in situations where you expect emergence of classicality. I call this emergence of the preferred set of states Ein selection, as in the title, environment-induced superselection. It's this propensity of the interaction between the system and the environment to choose a preferred set of states. Of course, the price for this preference implemented is the increase of entropy. Information leaks out to the environment. You lose some information. Decoherence destroys superpositions of preferred states. Now, if decoherence will do the same thing to the computer, it will make the sophisticated interference experiment, which the quantum computation is, impossible. The obvious question is to ask, what is the preferred set of states which emerge on the diagonal of the density matrix? One simple answer for models where you can ignore self-Hamiltonian of the system is that basically the constants of motion under the interaction Hamiltonian, the eigenstates, are the preferred states. In more interesting situations, the answers need to be looked at more carefully. Standard example of decoherence is what happens in the interaction between a harmonic oscillator and a whole bunch of other harmonic oscillators. This model was treated since sort of mid-40s. The most influential papers were by Feynman and Vernon, and by Caldera and Leggett, and that paper was written, I think, also here at ITP in 84. We've written something with Bill Unruh where we've improved somewhat on what Caldera and Leggett did. Since then, a number of people in the audience, Ingold, Grabert, Juan Pablo Paz, have written papers which essentially settled the issue. Point is, you have a preferred degree of freedom. This may be part of your quantum computer, and a set of degrees of freedom, which are the environment. The whole system is linear, therefore you can obtain the exact solution, trace out the field, and compute the evolution of the density matrix of the system alone. When you do that, you will end up with what's known as a master equation, and under the right set of approximations, that master equation is a high-temperature master equation, which I've written here. High-temperature master equation assumes essentially that the decoherence is dominated by thermal excitations present in the environment. You ignore the role of the vacuum. You can write equations valid at zero temperature. There is going to be still decoherence, although then equations become more complicated, and these terms are generally time-dependent. What does decoherence do? Let's look at this equation. It is written here in position-position representation for one-dimensional harmonic oscillator. The first piece is just a von Neumann bracket with renormalized Hamiltonian. Second piece turns out to correspond to relaxation. The system will lose energy or momentum through the second term. The third piece is in some sense most interesting. It stands out. One way to see it stand out is to do an illegal thing and let h bar go to zero. Now, we all know this is not really a classical limit, right? I mean, you can do it in mathematics, but one thing that's clear is that if you let h bar go to zero, this piece will dominate. So let's just for the moment forget about the other two and see what happens when this piece dominates. When it does dominate, you can write the solution for the density matrix right away. Basically, everything on the diagonal stays the way it was. Everything away from the diagonal gets dumped. To see what sort of effect this has on superpositions, we can start with a wave function that looks like this. If we start with this wave function, then the density matrix corresponding to it in position-position representation will be like this. The two peaks on the diagonal correspond to the locations of where the particle can be. The two peaks away from the diagonal encode the information about the coherence between the pieces of the wave packet. If you let time go on and the environment find out about the location of the particle, coherence disappears. The off-diagonal peaks shrink. What's interesting is the rate at which they shrink. It turns out that rate, decoherence rate, is proportional to the rate at which the system would lose energy. So if you isolated the system perfectly, then in this model, perfect, really perfect isolation would mean no decoherence. However, that relaxation rate has to be multiplied by the separation between the pieces of the wave packet divided or expressed in the units of thermal de Broglie wavelengths. So yes, it's proportional to the relaxation rate, but when you are dealing with an object which is, for instance, 1 gram in mass, room temperature, and a separation of 1 centimeter, this factor is 10 to the 40. The rate at which you lose coherence is much, much faster than the rate at which you leak energy. Very clearly, preserving quantum information in its quantum pristine state is going to be very difficult if one has superpositions which are large. Now, before I tell you about the bad things, which it obviously does to quantum computation, let me tell you very briefly about some good things it does, which is it does tell you how to select the stable classical island in the Hilbert space. Basically, you can imagine a process which I call predictability sieve, which tells you which of the states in this whole Hilbert space remain unperturbed in spite of the coupling with the environment. One way of doing it is you start with the list of all the Hilbert states in the Hilbert space. And I don't mean a complete basis. I mean every superposition of every superposition. Then you compute the resulting density matrix for each of these states. And then you compute a functional, which is the entropy, for example, corresponding to the density matrix. States which have not lost much information are good classical states. There's a longer discussion, obviously, here, and I'm happy to entertain it, but perhaps not at this point. You can get Hilbert space separated fairly sharply into classical and quantum domain using this strategy. I'm skipping over transparencies which demonstrated to go back to quantum computation. Now, if there are these enemies of quantum computation, if every coupling with the environment, every imperfection at the gate causes so much trouble, then how can we ever hope to do a quantum computation? This question seemed to be an insurmountable difficulty when people started thinking about it very, very seriously early on, because it was known that you cannot implement, at least directly, the strategy which is used classically in order to make information robust. You cannot produce many copies of something quantum mechanically. You cannot clone an unknown quantum state. Now, turns out, in spite of that, and again, Peter Shor and in this case, Andy Steen contributed to this, you can use many of the strategies which are used for classical error correction, but just translate them in a non-trivial way into a quantum domain. Now, a very simple way of dealing with it, which doesn't correct for all possible errors, but corrects for errors which are due to decoherence, the phase errors, is implemented here with the help of three quantum bits. You encode your state in a superposition of pluses and minuses, remember the Hadamard transform, and then if phase errors fed into your system flip a phase in one of these three bits, you can still find out A, that the state has been corrupted, B, which bit has been corrupted, and you do it not by finding out the phase one by one, but comparing, asking the question, is the phase in these two bits, in all three bits the same, and if not, in which of the bits the phase is different, and then fixing it. This is possible. First code of Peter Shor was actually a code which was sort of a square of that code. It had 9 bits, it had a triple in a triple. The first error correction was of phases, second error correction was a flip of between 0 and 1. If you have a slow error rate compared to how often you perform this sort of strategy, you can keep your code your quantum state encoded in this fashion from getting corrupted. Slow means you have to make sure that only one, at most, error sneaks in between your attempts to error correct. There are many more, much more sophisticated codes which have been written since. Again, a lot of work on error correction was done 5 years ago at ITP. This particular 3-bit code was even implemented experimentally in NMR, and it turns out to error correct. No big surprise. I'm showing it more to show the next picture, which I like for other reasons than the previous one. This is a gang of people who did the experimental work. You can tell who the mathematician is, I think. And you can also tell who's from Australia. The bottom line is that it has been since realized that as long as you can keep errors small enough, you can perform quantum computation ad infinitum. Now, it sounds great. It actually is not as good or as optimistic a conclusion of the story as one would have wanted, because these error thresholds turn out to be small, at least if you want to guard against reasonably general sorts of errors, and B, it turns out that the price that you pay for being able to compute for a very long time is having a very big quantum computer. Basically, what you do is you encode bits in bits which are already encoded. You build the levels of encoding on top of each other. And that costs memory. But existence of these error thresholds is very important. So I've essentially run out of time. I've almost run out of transparency, but not quite. Let me lay down one more, which is, I don't know if it's optimistic or not, but I think it's important to realize that something like this is ahead of us in the future. You see, when you extrapolate what's known as Moore's Law, and this is Moore's Law, it's taken by people who build computers, design chips, etc., as if it was a law of nature. Okay? I mean, you go to these conferences and they know that 10 years from now, they're going to be building chips which are going to have this size of wires implanted on them, etc., etc., etc. Okay? They don't extrapolate their tables more than 10 years. There's a good reason for that. 20 years from now or so, they run into the size of an individual memory element equal to an atom. A year and a half or 2 years ago when I was giving a talk, I was starting with this transparency and telling people, first asking them, do they know about Y2K problem? And everybody knew that. And that problem came and went away. And then I'm telling them then, look, there is another problem. Year 2.19K problem. That's not going to go away. This is a year 2.19 problem. 2.019 problem. So, in the reasonably near future, whether we want it or not, the ultimate place where the information is stored in the computer is going to hit the quantum barrier. We can either fear it or try to bypass it and use elements at this level as if they were classical, or try to take advantage of it. It's not clear if we'll succeed. I mean, these problems with decoherence are serious. But in some sense, it is inevitable that we are going to be faced with working on quantum computation. Industry is going to be faced with working on quantum computation. It may be, in spite of problems with decoherence, etc., that quantum information processing is a solvable problem, that one may be able actually to build hardware which processes non-trivial numbers of bits. And regardless of that, I mean, I don't know how many of you are, you know, excited by the prospect of factoring a number with 1,000 digits. Quantum information forces one to think about extremely interesting problems of very fundamental nature. Thank you.
Take questions.
Happily.
I didn't quite understand. When you're talking about this quantum error correction, you said you replace one bit by three, and then you can see if one's been corrupted by comparing. But of course, you can't actually measure each of the bits, right? Because that destroys all the superstition. So how do you know if one's been flipped without sort of looking at each bit?
Very good question. So what you make is a measurement which establishes if one of them was flipped, without asking a specific bit about its state. So you make a comparison between three. You never ask questions of individual guys. So the information, the quantum information that you want to protect can still hide sort of in the entanglement between the three. And this lets me make one more comment, which I think is important. I told you before that one of the big worries of Roald Landauer, and a very correct worry, was that in some sense the evolution of a quantum state is an analog process. Okay, this is true, but error correction is not, right? If you ask a question of a quantum system in a two-state Hilbert space, it has to say yes or no. It cannot say maybe. So error correction is a digital process. So in some sense, this is, you know, to me, a resolution of the big worry we've had. You really error correct by digitizing the occasionally something which, in some bigger sense, is analog.
So, 10 or 15 years ago or so, when people first started coming through here and uttering the words decoherence, it was usually connected to cosmology and you know, the wave function of the universe. Perhaps even yourself. Perhaps even you were one of those speakers. Could you comment on sort of what your perspective is on how all this enormous development in the field will or will not feed back to subjects like cosmology?
I mean, it's, you know, there's another lecture here, obviously, and it's not the right time to start it. but very briefly, I think, if nothing else, the attempts to process quantum information in a quantum coherent way will force one to understand in detail the process of decoherence and in detail the relevance of it to the emergence of classicality. I mean, in some sense, you know, the reason classical computers don't worry about decoherence is that there it's legal to know what the state of the computer is. Now, you know, there's a big jump between spin one half things and the universe, right? And so extrapolations, in some sense, are a dangerous process, and there are also some aspects of the theory on large scale which I think people honestly don't know, don't understand. I mean, quantizing gravity, right? I mean, that's a big one. So it's very hard for me to. I mean, it's very easy to make glib statements, but I don't want to overdo it. So perhaps I should simply stop here.
If I understand correctly, the basis of the interest in quantum computing among the more mathematically oriented people is that it somehow should be fundamentally faster than a classical computer. But if I understand correctly, I think you also alluded to that in your talk, this is more like a conjecture, it's not a theorem.
Oh, no, it is a theorem. I mean, there are examples, right? I mean, Shor's algorithm is an algorithm for, well, let me restate it, okay?
I thought it was not proven that.
What is not proven is that you cannot do factoring faster classically than the fastest way to do factoring classically now. Okay, but it's very clear that there is already a quantum algorithm, which beats the heck out of the classical algorithm, simply because the best classical algorithm is exponential in third root of the length of the number you're trying to factor, and quantum algorithm is polynomial. Right? This is a humongous change. So I think this is established. Right? I mean, what is not established is that you cannot, have a brilliant idea which will classically allow you to do factoring faster. But it's very clear that there are algorithms which are, quantum mechanics already exist, which are much, much better. I mean, and there is another one, which, I mean, to me, in some sense, the focus on the Shor's algorithm or the focus on search algorithm, Grover's algorithm, which is another one which is very well known, is at the same time justified, but in some sense comes at the expense of the application which is dearest to my heart and which is sort of obvious, which is simulating quantum systems. I mean, it's embarrassing that one, but true, that you cannot simulate, a Heisenberg magnet with more than, 20 or 30 things, right? I mean, if you could do it with 1,000, we would learn a lot of different things. So I think, in some sense, that it's sort of obvious. I mean, again, you can't prove that there won't be a classical algorithm, but it's very plausible. Or if we came up with one, great.
Coming from that, relative to oracles, there is a quantum advantage of it.
Thank Wojciech again.